Welcome to the Thought Leaders Podcast. We discuss what's trending in the online sphere. From podcast ad tech to the explosion of gaming, we sit down with experts in the field who share their experiences, successes, setbacks, and tips for anyone who wants to understand more about the world of digital content.
Hello, everybody. I am joined here today with Craig Hewitt, the founder and CEO of Castos. Craig, how's it going?
Doing well, David. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot for joining us, and I am super interested in talking with you today because we are diving deep into the world of podcast hosts at Thought Leaders. So I have a ton of questions for you about podcast hosts and your journey there. Before we get into Castos and what you're doing today, I'd love for you to just give us kind of the quick background that took you to Castos and to founding the company.
Yeah, for sure. So Castos itself is a few years old. We're about 4 years old. And previously I was kind of founder and CEO of a productized service in the podcasting space called Podcast Motor. It was my first kind of online business baby, I like to say, and it kind of segued really nicely, and still that service kind of lives inside Castos, and we call it Castos Productions. But the opportunity came up to acquire a WordPress plugin called Seriously Simple Podcasting. And that was really how Castos got its start, is we acquired this WordPress plugin with a bunch of free users. So kind of acquired a user base, or a marketing channel, I guess, or customer acquisition channel that was not being monetized, and then built the Castos hosting platform that integrated with the WordPress plugin. And for about 8 or 9 months, that was the only way that you could use Castos. And then we built to where you can use it by itself, to where now about half our customers use Castos by itself. They don't have a dedicated website for their podcast, or they use it along with our WordPress integration through Seriously Simple Podcasting.
Very cool. I didn't know that, but that's how it all started, from this acquisition. I mean, that sounds like a pretty big decision to decide to acquire another company or another product and then kick off the business like that. Was that a really big decision for you?
Yeah, I mean, since it wasn't monetized, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was a pretty big investment of like direction. You know, like we're acquiring this, we're going to build this product. And you know, it is to build products, like it's just 6 months or 4 months or whatever of cost and effort and everything. And so, yeah, I mean, in hindsight, it's a pretty big bet that, you know, hey, we're going to, you know, put the capital up front to acquire this thing, and then we're going to go pay a developer for a few months to build the first version of the product. You have to feel pretty convinced that this will work. But we had, you know, another company in the space with almost the exact same model, right? There's another podcasting plugin and there's a hosting platform that's connected to it. And so we kind of just said, we think we can do it better than them. And I think that's not a terrible way to look at it. You know, it's like, hey, go into a space with existing competitors that people don't like and that you think you can do better than, because it takes some of the risk away of like, hey, is this newfangled thing going to work or not? Can we have a way for people to find us and have a customer acquisition channel? If you can answer some of those questions up front, then it makes it slightly less risky.
So for you up front, the validation was basically that WordPress was the customer acquisition channel. Is that correct?
Yep.
And what does that mean exactly for everyone listening? So basically people are going into the WordPress marketplace, and that was your kind of like, they were just naturally with WordPress SEO juice finding your WordPress plugin because that's what they were searching for?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's kind of a freemium model, right? The WordPress plugins in the WordPress.org repository have to be free and open source, and ours definitely is. And then from there, some percentage of those people install the plugin, see our hosting option, and upgrade to the paid service on top of that.
But it's really interesting when you think about it like that, that basically your original user flow was all based on like the discovery that the marketplace itself would bring you.
Yeah.
What were you doing were you doing SEO within the marketplace, or what are kind of the ways that you're able to make sure? I imagine if I go in today and I just pop a WordPress plugin on the marketplace, that nobody sees it, right? There's like millions of them. So what were you doing, and how was that your discovery mechanism?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it, is that the plugin already ranked well for the term podcast, even audio. And so we knew that, you know, people searching will see us alongside maybe a couple other people that are suitable to kind of candidates for what they're looking to do. And so that was part of the calculus, like, hey, this is a good base on which we can build and kind of de-risks, as opposed to just starting, you know, a Calendly clone from scratch. Like, that's literally starting from zero, and we weren't. So it was nice.
Very cool. Okay, so you start building out the beginnings of what turns into Castos, and you do it in a pretty different way from most businesses. You decide to bootstrap it. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, so we're fortunate to have like revenues from Podcast Motor, the product I service business, to support me and my family and pay rent and things like that, and support the developer who kind of wrote the first version of the product. And it was all I ever knew, you know, like I'd never raised money, and subsequently like we have, but like never raised money, didn't understand what it was all about. And a lot of the kind of bootstrapper world, there is this really bad stigma around raising money, that you're like selling out and that you're not standing there for the customers or anything like that. And I think that could be the case, you know, in true VC, you know, billion-dollar valuation or die kind of world. But yeah, I mean, it was all I knew, and we could do it. And so I think that that's like not a bad reason to choose to bootstrap something, is like, if you can, from a capacity and a time perspective, you know, like a money capacity and a time perspective, that bootstrapping just gives you options. You know, it's like being a profitable company. You have options. You can go faster, spend more money on this thing, pull back, just wait and kind of go slow. And whereas when you take money, then a lot of those choices are taken away from you. And I think that the degree to which you take money, I guess, takes more and more options away from you, to where ultimately, if you take VC money, you're on a track, you know, you're going to raise a Series A and a Series B, and then you're going to go public or sell to a PE firm. Whereas, you know, the rest of us still have quite a few options.
But when you decided to go that route at the beginning, I mean, you mentioned that it was the only thing you knew, or that it was possible, but was there something in your head that was like, I really value the freedom to choose my track, or was it just kind of autopilot? It, you know, said, I want to build this business, let's just do it. And you started running.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, like, our situation's a little unique, maybe, that the industry that we're in doesn't lend itself to kind of slow and steady, certainly now. And even 4 years ago, it was not quite like this, but you know, you see Spotify coming in and buying Anchor and Megaphone and Omni Studio selling to Amazon and all of this activity going on, you know, both funding and like acquisition activity going on in the podcasting space. More recently made me say like, hey, bootstrapping this is not the right approach to the business now. At the time, like, I didn't know any of that, and I wasn't really aware of like all of these dynamics. I just kind of said, I have enough money to buy this plugin, and we can afford $5,000 a month for a developer. Let's do this and see what happens. And we're fortunate that, like, since we had the customer acquisition channel kind of built in, that the company grew pretty quickly to where we could continue to grow the company and spend money on things like more developers and marketing and things like that without needing to raise money. Until we got to a point where we said, ooh, there's like really something here. We've proven quite a bit of history and growth and everything, to where like taking money is another kind of calculated move. And we can get into that maybe, but yeah, that was kind of the origins of bootstrapping for us.
So as I mentioned to you before we hopped into the interview, we're doing the same thing as we've always been a bootstrap company. And these are questions I'm asking myself all the time. So what was that moment for you that you said, okay, we're something's different, something changed, like, now is the time. Now is the time. It's not a year from now. Now is the time to start trying to raise money.
Yeah. I mean, it really was like a market dynamics kind of situation where like the advent of private podcasting kind of came about early last year, maybe early 2020. And we got into the space pretty early and saw some early success, and not just with, I'll say like conventional customers, but with some enterprise customers. And like, if you've ever sold enterprise, you know, like they move the needle really quick and they're like big and complicated projects and sales cycles and everything. But if you can figure it out, like it really transforms the growth trajectory of the business. And so we just dumb luck kind of happened into a couple of those opportunities and then said like, we just want to do more of this. You know, we want to do more of it. We know that private podcasting is in its infancy. We're in the space, and if we don't do as much as we can into this space right now, I'll regret it in 5 years when, you know, some other company comes and becomes the market leader in this. It was, you know, hey, right now there's all this interest and activity and funding and podcasting. We are an established participant, maybe a leader in some respects, and we have a really good opportunity to take a big shot at this, as opposed to, like, if you keep bootstrapping, you can take a bunch of little shots. But if we raise some money, we can go hire like five people right now, you know, and like five more people to a company, you know, our size is a really big deal. And you can start doing so many more things than if we were to continue to be bootstrapping. It's just a function of time. Like, we'd get there eventually. But then, like, would the momentum of the market have left by then? And like, would another player have taken our spot as like a leader in the space?
So a couple questions. First of all, take us through, for everyone listening, what exactly is private podcasting? And how did that come on the scene about a year ago?
Yeah, so private podcasting, think of it like a membership site in audio format. So you might have this podcast as like a conventional public podcast. It's in Apple Podcasts and Spotify and all that, and you use it like as a marketing thing. You also might have an exclusive members-only episode that comes out once a month, maybe, where you interview the Collison brothers, right? Or someone like that, right? And that's like premium member only content that is only available for people who pay like a monthly subscription or a part of your community or something like that. And so for us, private podcasting has kind of two personas that are attached to it. One is that, right? So someone who has a course or a membership site or a community where they want to kind of bolt on private podcasting as a way to share premium kind of content with their members. And the other one, which is the enterprise one, is companies using it as an internal communications tool. So we have a private podcast at Castos. We help, you know, a bunch of companies with their podcasts internally for them to share information in a secure and confidential way with their employees, that they don't want to hop on another Zoom call. They don't want to write as an email. They don't want to post as a memo on their SharePoint site. And they want to give their employees a way to connect with this content that otherwise is siloed in some garbage, you know, intranet somewhere that they're never going to access, in a way that's like mobile and on demand, and people can consume it when and how they want.
So which one of those use cases led to the enterprise customers joining?
A little of both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very cool. Can you walk us through what that kind of business model, what is a large account, an enterprise for either a business that decides to, a company that decides to do something internal, or someone who decides to do the subscription model?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of our pricing is that right on our website, so castos.com/pricing. I'll take a half a step back a little bit. Anyone who kind of runs a SaaS business that has the potential for expansion revenue knows that it is like the magic lever, right, in the business. You don't need more customers, you just need your customers to kind of be more successful with your tool, to where they add seats to a CRM or they get more email subscribers in an ESP, to where you have 100 customers and this month they're paying you $15 more each and you magically have this magic growth. Podcast hosting typically has not had that kind of pricing model kind of accepted in the industry. You know, we have plans starting at $19 a month, and for someone to grow from 19 to 49 to 99 used to be and kind of usually is like a feature gated thing. And that's how today our pricing is. Private podcasting gives us the opportunity to price our service on the number of private subscribers that someone has to their podcast. So think about, you have a course with 10,000 people enrolled in it, and you want to enroll all of those people in a private podcast. We would price that based on the number of people that you want to enroll, as opposed to like the conventional podcasting world, where like if you host this podcast on Castos and you have 1,000 or 10,000 listeners per episode, we price it the same. And so just from a like a unit economics perspective, it's a really big lever we can pull to say like the value really is there, right? So it's like an appropriate value metric in terms of pricing, I think, that like the person with a 10,000 member course or student course is going to get a heck of a lot more out of working with us than the person with 100 people in a course and offering a private podcast to both of them. So so it makes sense for both sides. It's a great opportunity for us to experience expansion revenue and have higher priced customers. And it's a really good thing for our customers, because they understand that, like, the more people they can reach in this modality, the you know, the better their communication internally if they're a company, and the better their connection with their audience or their students or their community is.
So, I mean, it sounds, that's exactly what I was looking for, what you talk about, the expansion revenue there, or how that business model works on the private side, so that you can get a single account paying a lot of money.
Yep.
It sounds like private podcasting, you mentioned it came onto the scene really heavily about a year ago. It sounds like that's, you know, something that a lot of companies are going to start going after. Is that the case, or are you really, you know, firmly in the position as like leader in this?
Both, maybe.
Both.
we are very early in this as a thing. You know, we talk to, you know, very frankly, we talk to a lot of prospective leads and customers, and they say, "Oh, that sounds cool, but I don't have that problem right now." And of course, I would argue that's not the case. You know, I think that almost all companies suffer from a degree of like employee apathy and lack of engagement. And this is a really good way to cure that. But I also know that this is a new thing, and that companies that are coming to us and saying, "Hey, we understand that we have this problem of low employee engagement, people kind of checking out. The transition to remote with COVID has kind of emphasized and accelerated this for a lot of companies, to where they're like, we're a natively remote company, right? So like, we've always been remote and we'll always be remote. But if you're 3M, right, and you've been in New Jersey or wherever they're from for 150 years, and then you just have to be remote, like, it's a huge DNA shift for a lot of these companies. And so, like, I think a lot of them are grasping at a lot of different ways that they can connect with their employees, because their whole work life has been turned on its head recently. And unfortunately, I don't think that's changing anytime soon with what we're seeing of COVID.
Yeah, I definitely understand. I mean, as you say, we're in the beginnings of this trend, which is only going to increase, with people for the two use cases, and maybe even more, finding private podcasting to be really valuable. So the company use case makes a lot of sense to me. And that sounds like a really smart way to do it. On the subscriber side, right? So the other use case we're talking about is basically a creator comes and says, instead of going about monetizing my podcast by trying to, in short, get the most listeners I can and then sell ads to brands, they're saying, I'm going to monetize directly from those listeners, right? I'm going to charge them some amount of money. And that's my monetization. Can you talk about some of the decisions that a subscriber-funded podcast creator would need to be thinking about, such as how much to charge or what type of content fits for a subscription model instead of ad? Any other major decisions they might be making?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, like, the types of customers that we work with predominantly have something going on other than the podcast that is a big value that they offer to people that pay them money every month. So it's a course, or it's a community, it's a membership site, and they use podcasting as a way to communicate with those students or members. I say that because the reality is, for you or I to start a podcast, and the only way we make money is from our podcast, is really freaking hard. Dream of, I'm, quote, just going to podcast and people are going to pay me $10 a month. It is definitely possible, and we have people doing it, but it is the vast exception. And so I think that for us, like, as a business, it's also more of a sure thing for someone to come with an existing business, and they have these thousands of students in their course or on their membership site. Like, that's already there. Like, the value of being able to connect with all of those people via podcasting as a medium, it makes just a ton of sense. Whereas David deciding to start a podcast and charging $10 a month, like, you have a huge mountain to climb to market to those people, to convince them to buy, to have free content anyhow for them to, like, to see as freemium. And so, like, that would just be, like, the caution, I would say, is it's absolutely possible to create a really awesome podcast and charge money for it. If you look at newspapers, right, as, like, the precursors to this, like, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal struggled with this for a long time before they figured out how to do it, I think. And so I would just say, like, if you're thinking about that as the way, just be really sure of kind of how you're planning on doing it, which is exactly the question you asked. And I think the way to do it that we see the most successful is something like I talked about before, where you have some amount of content that's free, and it's a podcast that's available on iTunes and Spotify and all that. And then you have some member-only podcast content. And so that's one episode or two episodes a month. That is your best stuff, usually. So it's the episode you record with the big name guest, or the behind the scenes episode, or something like that. And generally people are looking at charging like $5 or $10 a month per person that wants to access this, per customer. I think that one thing that we see as a commonality with all of the private podcasters in the creator space, like you mentioned, that have in common is they're all really good digital marketers. They're all really, really savvy with their marketing automation or email service provider, really savvy with what's on the website and the calls to actions and kind of creating those funnels. And, mm-hmm. and it's not surprising. I mean, like selling membership, selling content is a really well kind of understood thing. And people, a lot of people are very, very good at it. I think a lot of us in SaaS should take a lot of lessons from how they kind of capture their audience and convert them. But I mean, that's what I would say is like the best models we see are freemium, where you release, you know, the majority of your content free, you reserve some of it under the paywall. And then the best ones though have like something else behind it. And usually that is a degree of community. So they have members talking amongst each other, whether it's a Facebook channel or Discord or Discourse or whatever it is, a way for people to continue the conversation. Because a lot of times, like the podcast is just the tip of the iceberg, right? The podcast is like the place where the conversation starts about this thing. And then you want a way for people to say, oh, I can't believe what John was saying about XYZ. I want to, you know, talk more about that. So that is like 100% the thread that's consistent between all of our really successful customers is the degree of community that they have.
So let's say like the pure podcast subscription, you know, I only do a podcast and I charge money for it. You're not very bullish on this as the trend, and it comes into all these other pieces and building something, and this is part of it, right? But something I'm curious about is, so we see like Substack and Patreon and OnlyFans, and you know, Andreessen Horowitz is investing in Substack, and you know, like getting, there's a lot of funding going into this kind of like tipping. Not necessarily, it's not only like monthly subscriptions, it's also like tipping and giving creators money directly from the audience. But it sounds like you're not super bullish on this trend. You're playing a little bit, almost a little bit safer, that the subscription podcast should be something that's part of like the bigger picture. Is that right?
Yeah. I want to be careful, because it's not that I'm not bullish on it, because as opposed to the alternative, it's a hell of a lot better. Right. And the alternative you alluded to is ads, which is just mm-hmm. horrible. Right. And like, I don't know that we will ever build an ad engine into Castos, just because I think it's a garbage way to monetize a podcast. The much better way is to sell like the premium content directly. What I would say is that only doing either one of those is much harder than having some other big kind of piece of value for your subscribers or your members or your students that they latch onto, and podcasting is a part of that. Just because there's a lot more value to it. You know, there's a lot more value to community than to you just listening to a piece of audio for 30 minutes.
Do you think podcasters have to choose only one monetization method? Could they, like, could you do ads and have some of your content gated and charged?
Yeah, for sure. And that's definitely a relatively common one is like the public free podcast has ads in it. And if you want the ad free version, pay $5 a month. That's the way that that's the way that some people do it.
So, but Castos' specialty is the private podcast, right? When you go on your homepage, that's almost the first thing you see, right? That's really how you're positioning Castos for the future, is that's our killer feature and that's our specialty.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, one, because like conventional podcasting is pretty well understood. You know, it's not that complicated. You store audio files, you deliver them to listeners, you give analytics, you make it a really beautiful, cool tool, and that's it. But where we think differently, and where we try to stand apart from the rest of the industry is like, we're not just some standalone tool that you publish your podcast on and then copy some crappy iframe into a site. But like what we're building is our tool as the center of like your audio world, right? And so we have a bunch of integrations and we're building out another like half dozen this year to connect Castos to other things you do. So think about like from a private podcasting perspective, if you run a Shopify site, and you want to send like kind of an onboarding podcast to someone that buys your premium thing, right? You can do that today, right? With Castos. Think about like we're building an integration right now with ConvertKit. Think about like if you're using ConvertKit Commerce and someone buys, you know, product X, you can go into Castos and say, hey, when someone buys product X, subscribe them to private podcast A. And all of these things. And then on the kind of output side, think about like when I publish a new podcast in Castos, send a MailChimp newsletter to my list. So just building a bunch of automations and workflows to where things can kind of plug into Castos and things can kind of be the result of something that happens in Castos. Because as you know, like we all use 1,000 tools every day, and for them not to talk to each other is garbage. And we think of podcasting for like a really savvy podcaster who's getting into private podcasting and doing other things with digital marketing tools, like they want their podcast and the things that happen around their podcast to talk to the other tools that they're using, and no one else is doing this.
It sounds like you're really, your target podcaster is someone who's running a business, who has things to sell, who has merchandise, who has courses, who has this community that they're directly speaking to and engaging with. And it's less about, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe like the super premium produced content where like that's the only thing we do is this is our main show and we spend a ton of money on it. And it's just like this show, you know, listen in each week or each day.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have a lot of those podcasts, I think, that people that are real purists in terms of like the audio and the style of podcasting from a product and business model perspective, I guess, like there's just less we can do with that. Opposed to, you know, the value that someone gets from integrations and private podcasting and things like that are really, really high. For us, a customer that just tops and tails and runs their podcast through Ophonic, versus someone that spends 10 hours editing it. Like to us, I think the value they get from our tool is similar. And so we're kind of saying like, hey, we see this place over here where people get a lot of value out of us, you know, creating a platform that's really extensible. And so we're catering to that side of things a lot.
So what does Castos look like in 3 years or 4 years from now?
Wow. Yeah, that's a really good question. So that's the second time today someone's asked me that question. So we're 16 people right now. In, you know, 3 or 4 years, I would expect us to be like 50 people and serving, you know, tens of thousands of customers and hopefully very much a leader in the private podcasting space, both for the creator, you know, people that are using it with their courses and communities and membership sites, as well as for companies as an internal communications tool. I mean, it is, like you said, it's front and center on our website, and private podcasting for those two use cases is our big focus right now.
So if I'm just doing the quick kind of back of the napkin math here, is that if you're going from 16 to 50, let's say in 3-4 years, it doesn't sound like in you're running like head first into another investment round, a bigger round soon, or going a hardcore, you know, VC route. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's definitely the plan right now. We took a pretty big amount of money, about $750,000 earlier this year. And don't have any plans to raise any more. And I qualify that with like fundraising and venture funding or funding of any kind is just like a tool, you know? And so if the best thing for our investors and our company and our employees and our customers and me is for us to raise more money, then we will. But if it's not the best thing, then we don't want to go raise money just because we can, because I think that's kind of silly.
It's a pretty unique, I think, place that you're in, that you went the bootstrapping route in the beginning, then you did raise some money, but now you're not necessarily raising more, right? You're not like on the funding path. Do you have an exit strategy in mind for the company?
There's a couple of options that we have. I think if you look at like what we're doing, that there are a handful or dozen people that you would call like strategic opportunities, strategic acquirer opportunities. Someone on our team mentioned this the other day, that like as we get into the private podcasting space, that things like Salesforce could be an opportunity to acquire us. I mean, they just finished the acquisition of Slack. And in a way, like what we're becoming is not so different than Slack. And so like, I think if you look at some of those kinds of tools, that might be an option. I think about tools like Teachable, potentially, you know, they're also not so different than us. And then I think that, you know, the way we raised money also, you know, just lets us grow for another, like you said, 3 or 4 years. And then, you know, we do have investors and they do want to see a return. And so at some point we will need to sell the business. But I think we have the options to do that on our terms and, you know, when and how we want.
Okay. But there's definitely a clear, like, we will sell the business at some point, and it's not going to be that we build this business and live off of like killer profits forever. We're going to sell this business.
I mean, when you take money, that becomes like running a lifestyle business and making $300,000 a year in profits and stuff like that is just not, it's not a responsible thing to do for our investors. And so, yeah, I mean, we are building the business as smartly and as quickly as we can to make it as valuable as possible.
Something I'm really interested in asking you about, I've heard you discuss this before, is that you believe pretty heavily in offering service offerings for SaaS companies. And that's also something that with Thought Leaders, we did from basically from day one. That allowed us to get revenue from day one and build out our SaaS offering. And it's really, you know, something that triggered in my head because it's pretty unique. I don't hear that a lot. There's sometimes a stigma against service offerings in SaaS, or that it's like not sexy revenue, or know that, you know, everything needs to be automation and infinitely scalable from the beginning. Do you think that there's still a place for service offerings in SaaS? And do you still believe so, I guess, strongly for it with the investment, or has that changed?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, our Castos production service was a pretty big part of the investment. I think the only participant in the market that does public and private podcasting and has a professional services arm. So if you walk into, again, I'll say like 3M, and they say, hey, cool, we want a podcast provider to do a public podcast for like marketing and branding. We want an internal podcast for corporate communications. And we don't have a person on our team that can do all this stuff. We want to hire Castos Productions at $200 an episode to do all of the work. And we can go, cool, we can do all of that. And so I think that understandably, like, yeah, our service is kind of hard sometimes. Yep. Like you have, especially the more kind of squishy the end result that you're providing is, the more complicated it gets, I think. You know, think about like if you're a lead gen service and you just provide 100 leads to a customer every week, like that's pretty cut and dry. For us, you know, as a podcast editing service, there's a fair amount of artistic interpretation, I guess, that goes into what we deliver. But we've been doing it for like 6.5 years. So like, I think we're pretty decent at it at this point. To answer your question, I would just say, yes, I think it is something that everyone should consider. Does it have to be a huge part of your revenue? No, but if you don't do it and you don't have someone who can go and kind of own it, I think you're just leaving a lot on the table, because what you're providing is like a partial solution.
Yeah, my favorite thing about the service offering is that it forces us to dog food our own product, and that we basically can drive the product roadmap from our own, you know, firsthand knowledge of like, this is actually the thing we need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we test internally like a lot of our new features with our Castos production service. And yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to dog food stuff. Yeah.
Do you have co-founders in the business with you?
Nope, it's just me.
So that's also pretty unique. How has that been basically for the better part of 4 years and kind of even before that, you're being the only founder?
Mostly good. Like it fits my personality. Well, like I would feel really guilty that I wasn't doing enough if I had a co-founder, especially if we were similar. I think if I had a technical co-founder, that would be really easy because I'm not a developer. So like, hey, you go run the product, I'll do sales and marketing. But it's such an intense relationship that like I just haven't been in the opportunity to start something with someone else. And damn it, at this point, it's too late to consider a co-founder. But I will say, anyone that's a single founder knows that it can be lonely. Because you just, you know, Josh Pigford called it decision fatigue, right? You're just making hundreds of decisions every day all by yourself. And really there's no one to talk to because you can't go talk to, you know, your team members about certain things. And so I rely on, you know, advisors and coaches and peers and things like that.
So then how's the company structured? Do you have an executive team or who's reporting to you? What are the people, the roles that you have in the company?
Yeah. Yeah. So we have, yeah, we call it a leadership team and they kind of span the functional areas of the company. So support, success. I kind of run sales. We have a head of marketing and then we have a developer manager. Mm-hmm. And the last one is we have a designer who kind of owns product, but that's a squishy kind of place for us. I think that's somewhere that we'll hire soon is like a product owner. At the point we are 5 full stack developers and a front end developer plus a designer. Someone needs to be owning product. We brought on an engineering manager a few months ago, and that's been really nice to really just organize all the work that the engineering and the product team is doing.
But yeah, it sounds, especially with the roadmap and the pen you're talking about, where there's a lot of integrations and a lot of, I guess, connecting parts, right? It doesn't sound like your roadmap is very much about adding a lot of things to the kind of this core host that you have, as opposed to maybe a different type of company's roadmap would be very much like, all right, we have this feature and let's make this feature better and let's add on to this feature. Whereas you have a lot of connecting pieces. It sounds like it definitely needs, it's a difficult thing to orchestrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I also heard recently that you acquired a podcast. Is that correct?
We did. Yeah. We acquired the 3 Clips podcast earlier this year. Yeah. It's been a really great experience. Jay is, you're talking about like a really premium level content creator. And that's what 3 Clips is all about, is how to sound like NPR without having a 50 person team working on every episode.
Wow. So what's the secret?
Well, you have to listen to the podcast to find out. But I mean, no, Jay talks a lot about like the craft of storytelling and how to create really good content, but then also like really good audio, really good interviewing skills. He's fascinating to listen to and has on a bunch of really great guests, and they kind of break down podcast episodes to really find out like the why behind a lot of what someone has said on their show.
So how do you decide to acquire the podcast as opposed to, I don't know, advertising within it or maybe a different model? What goes through that decision?
If you look at the kinds of things we want to do and the kinds of customers we want to be associated with, like nothing better than having our own like calling card, right? Saying like, this is our podcast, this is who we are, and this is the kind of stuff we put out. And you know, we're fortunate that Jay has done all the hard work to build the podcast, mm-hmm. and it has a really strong reputation and brand behind it. And we're able to associate ourselves with that now. And so it's kind of the shortest route to say like, Castos is premium content. Okay. And people who really take their podcast seriously. And that was the goal of what we're trying to do with acquiring 3 Clips. And I think so far it's been really successful. We've had a lot of really interesting conversations, had a lot of really interesting, you know, folks come our way, because they're participants in the podcast and listeners of the podcast and kind of exposed to that world that Jay is crafting.
How do you get the Castos brand out to people throughout the podcast? Are you advertising within it, or, and how do you do it without like overdoing it.
Yeah, I mean, one of our, you know, main tenets with taking over the show was we're not going to screw it up. Like, that would be the absolute worst case scenario, is come in and stick a bunch of stuff in this podcast that doesn't belong. Like, that's just, that would be terrible. And so, you know, Jay is really tasteful in how he does it, but he mentions, you know, that the podcast is brought to you by Castos and has a blurb in each episode about some things that we're up to and new releases that we have and integrations and product features and things like that. So try to really tastefully, but intentionally, you know, mention what we're doing in the podcast, so folks know, hey, 3 clips equals Castos equals, you know, whatever we're talking about in that episode.
Okay. Really nice. It's actually something that we've thought about before as well. You know, if we should try to acquire a piece of media, whether it's a YouTube channel or a podcast, someone that's doing something that speaking to an audience that is our potential customers. Can you give me kind of a framework for, let's say, valuing that, or for another company that's maybe considering buying something? How do you even begin? Is it, you know, yeah. one way, for example, I thought it was, you know, thinking, okay, if I were to buy ads in it, then, you know, this many ads. But how do you go through it?
Yeah, I mean, that's not so far from what we did. The way it went with us, just frankly, is, you know, we said, hey, what about doing something together, right? And that can mean a lot of different things. Can we, hey, can we, you know, sponsor the podcast? Can we do kind of an exclusive series with you? Can we do something else? Or can we do, like, can we go and get married all the way, you know, and buy the podcast and retain Jay 100% as like the host of the podcast. And like, if you think about, you start putting a number value on any of those, and then you kind of extrapolate from there. Like, okay, it's $200 an episode, just round numbers, to sponsor an episode. And then, like, an exclusive series would be a couple $1,000s. And then the next step is a little more than that. And then, you know, taking over the whole thing plus, like, you know, some sort of retainer for you to stay on is more. So that's how we did it. I think you definitely could do exactly what you're saying. Like, okay, hey, for me to get this much brand exposure, we would need to buy X number of ads on, you know, related podcast. And we know that that means this. I also think that, well, first of all, half step back. I think this is a fantastic strategy for anyone looking to kind of shortcut their way to being in front of, like, the right audience. And I think the other thing is, like, the person selling it has to be on board for selling it, but also has to be on board for staying on, because otherwise what you end up with is, we've bought this podcast or this YouTube channel or this blog, and then the voice of it quite literally leaves, and you're there, like, trying to fill their shoes and probably won't do a great job. And so that was a really big part for us, was Jay being on board with the whole plan and, you know, hey, stay on at least for the first year, and keep doing exactly what you're doing, and we'll just be paying the bills.
That's really nice. I mentioned it's something that we've thought about doing before, and it was like, okay, how do you even go about valuing that, or how do you even go about deciding, making that decision? And something I got to tell you, I'm really impressed by, is that you made the decision to acquire something twice already. It's twice that we know about on the show that we've been talking about. So you don't just talk a big game. You make the decisions and you go through with it. And that's something that I can definitely admire, as we're still sitting here and we have not done it yet. So in your case, the acquisition was, let's say, a little bit less of like it's like a Castos exclusive, right? Does the podcast can still be accessed from let's say other players. It's not like, it didn't become like a private podcast right now, right?
Right. But, yeah, no, it's totally a public podcast. Yep.
But something that I think is happening a lot in the industry, we're starting to see, or at least the beginnings of something big, is a lot of the big players, not necessarily hosts, but it could be hosts as well, are buying exclusives or buying podcasts and making them exclusives. Is that something that you think we're going to continue seeing more of? And is that trend, does that affect you in any way?
I definitely think it's something that we'll continue to see. You see it with Spotify, right? You know, buying the Joe Rogan podcast and making it exclusive. I think it's tough because there are a lot of people that get very upset by that in the podcasting space. You know, podcasting by definition is an open medium. All podcasting is an RSS feed that should be accessible to everyone. And so siloing a podcast into only a certain channel for a publicly available podcast, I'll clarify, I think is not the best way to do it. I think the unbiased, of course, but I think like the better solution is, hey, make the public podcast available to everyone. You want as big of an audience, as big of a listenership as you can, and then carve out a chunk to make behind a paywall.
What's something, and you might have already actually said a couple of these on the show so far, but what's something that you think is maybe a trend in the podcasting space that you're pretty confident in, or something you really believe in, and most people think otherwise?
Try not to get myself in trouble too much with this one, but like, obviously I think private podcasting is a huge thing. And I don't think many people don't agree with that. But the next step of that is, like, I think the ad model to monetize podcasts is going away very quickly, because creators see that they can have much more control over how they monetize their content and don't have to sell out to Casper mattresses and all these things that just don't make sense with their brand and their message. A lot more money and visibility is coming into the podcasting space. And for advertisers, like that just means more money in the door. But I think that what we're going to see is, over time, savvy creators are going to say, like, I just don't have to do that, and so I'm not going to. I think we'll see the influx of advertising dollars into the market, but I think we'll also see more and more people kind of raise their hand and say, hey, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do this. And a bit of an exodus from people placing ads in their podcast.
Something really interesting that kind of what you guys did with acquisition and the, or some of the other models, is kind of this almost exit strategy for podcast creators for the first time. That wasn't such a common thing a while back. It wasn't such a common thing until very recently, actually. But what I wonder in the ad model, and I definitely see the problems with just a pure CPM play. You know, it takes a lot of listeners to get to be a podcast that can have any sort of, even cover cost for an episode, right? You want to transcribe your single episode, right? Or say it's $50, $100 for a transcription. Yep. You know, your hosting platform, and then suddenly, you know, you're like, wait, I need a pretty decent amount of listeners before I even cover my cost, let alone actually make money doing something that's pretty hard work. I do think that there's a place for brands to, let's say, pay much more than traditional CPMs if they can get to the right creator and the right audience that they're specifically looking for. And I guess what I'm wondering is there a way that can be done, let's say, at scale, right? I guess you can't do, every brand can't acquire like every podcast at scale, right? But is there a way that we can fix the ad model at scale where it can be really targeted, that brands are getting to who they need and they're willing to pay much more for it?
I definitely agree with the sentiment there that we are creating another original series. And so I guess I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. We will sell ads on this, but we will not in just the void of CPM and send this off and some algorithm decides what ads they want to stick in our podcast, but we will go directly to brands and say, all right, we have this 8-episode series. It's about this. It's going to reach this type of people. And we're going to charge $500 an episode. And like, that is the way to sell podcast advertising, especially with shows without much history or without significant download volume. It's a sales process. You have the value proposition of you and your voice and your content and your audience and how well that aligns with the brand that you're pitching. And it's not at all a CPM based thing. It's a value for this brand that you're pitching it to say, hey, do you want to get in front of, you know, 500 of your ideal customers every week for 2 minutes? How else are you going to do that for $500? You know, in the right context and frame the right way, that's a really easy decision for companies to buy into. Your question of how to do that at scale, I think is really tough, because it only works when you have really tight alignment between you and your voice and your brand and your message and the company, the sponsor that sees the value of that. And so ultimately, I think what you would need is a ton of potential sponsors for you to go into a conventional marketplace or something. I think that's just why you see the same advertisers over and over on so many podcasts. There's just not a ton of people advertising on podcasts these days.
Yeah, with thought leaders, so one of the things we're able to see is the brands inside the episodes. And that's one of the things that we track in thought leaders platform. So we're definitely seeing a heavy increase in brands getting into podcasts. But as you mentioned before, you said you think that the ad numbers will grow. But something that I don't think has been solved, at least across most brands, is the ability to track conversion really well and basically build a machine out of their podcast advertising. The brands, the few brands that have done this, the BetterHelp and the HelloFresh, and you know all the brands we're seeing in basically every single podcast, they're like the very few that have been able to build this kind of machine. They're paying a dollar and they're earning back $1.20 on the ads, right? But there's so many brands out there that are dipping their toes in the water now, because I think it's, you know, there's a lot of talk about podcasts being important in advertising, but they're still not able to figure out how to do that really effectively and make it a profitable kind of cycle for them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And I think analytics and visibility and trackability is a big part of that, right? As opposed to a Google AdWords ad or a Facebook ad and the amount of data consistency you can get there. In podcasting, it's just so segmented. You know, I listen to a podcast when I'm on a walk, and then I come home and I'm on my computer, and then I end up buying later on the couch on my iPad. Like that's just super hard to track. I do think there are some companies that have figured it out. And the more that the industry can do to improve that trackability or attribution, the better for getting more advertisers into the market for sure. And increasing CPMs, right? Because then they'll finally start seeing the value of like their message on a podcast.
How much are you thinking about the analytics offering that you have at Castos, and what are the features that you're working on there, or the metrics that you're exposing for your podcasters?
Yeah, I mean, analytics are a huge deal for all podcasters. And I think, you know, we currently provide a lot of what I would consider like our standard analytics. So, you know, downloads, device, operating system, app, browser type, geographic distribution. We have a unique metric that we call subscribers. It's kind of a behavioral based number that we give to you on a podcast level as a whole. You know, think about like how often people download an episode soon after it comes out. That's like the behavior of a subscriber. If I'm subscribed to a podcast and it drops on Tuesday morning, I download the episode right away. And so we give some of our customers that metric.
So that metric is only on certain plans? That's like, is that a more advanced metric?
Yep. Yeah, it's available in our pro plan. Is kind of like cross-platform too. So it's not just Apple Podcasts or anything like that. It's across all platforms.
And so then this is different than, let's say, the subscriber number that's listed on the platforms themselves. It's actually, you're basically, there's an algorithm for determining within a certain time frame if people are continuously downloading. Or is that, yep. Am I on the right track?
Yep,
that's
exactly.
Really cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. What can someone do with that metric? Or what are like the action items that I
use? Yeah, so we think like that's your core audience, right? So like in any podcast episode, you have 500 downloads, right? But like the people that listen to every episode you put out are kind of the ones that you really want to pay attention to. And so we think that the subscriber metric is that number, right? Is like, that's your core audience. They listen to every episode soon after it comes out. And we think that's kind of the gauge of who kind of your core audience is. And then from there, you know, people kind of listen onesie twosie, maybe on the website if they come across it, things like that. And those inflate your numbers a little bit beyond that core.
Do you know what is, I don't know, maybe some like averages or for the percentage of total listenership that should be core? For like, if I'm in a good situation with my podcast, you know, I have 25% of my listeners are core listeners, or is there some kind of benchmark like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't have a firm answer on that. I can give you a guess. I think it's about half for a lot of podcasts.
Oh, wow.
But I think it depends a lot on, you know, kind of like how rabid your listeners are. You know, if like, if you have a really strong following, it's going to be a higher number, obviously. If you have a lot of people that just stumble across your podcast on your website, it's obviously going to be a lower number.
It's a really interesting metric. And it's really cool that you guys developed like that, because I'm thinking of all the things. Okay, so once I can kind of build a baseline, then I definitely see your point in that I want more subscribers, right? Nobody says like, I want less subscribers. I'd rather have like less loyal following, right?
So, right.
Cool. Now I have this metric and I want to build it. I'm trying to think of all the ways that I can take some action to say, okay, let's get more of them, right? Like one thing that comes to mind is if I have really different content each episode, then maybe that's like less of something that would bring someone back to my show over and over. But if only one episode appeals to them, I'm curious of all the different ways that I can kind of do something to really improve that core following.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big, tough question. But I think generally, like, the framework to use there is to listen to your audience. And it goes back to that aspect of community, is like, get feedback from them. You know, podcasting, for better or worse, is inherently like a one-way medium. Like, we talk, people listen, and building a way for them to communicate back to you what they like and what they don't like gives you data to then craft like more of what they want and less of what they don't want. So, I mean, I think that's probably why we see community as like the common thread in our most successful shows. People are really clued into that in a data-driven way of like, they liked this, they didn't like that, and let's go make more of what they like.
What's the best way for a podcaster to be able to get that, get in touch with their community? As you mentioned, the podcast is pretty one-directional.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, building, again, like Discord or Discourse or Facebook or Slack or whatever it is, and then have that be a consistent call to action in the podcast. Say, hey, if you liked this, come over to the community and continue the discussion here. Or, hey, I'm going to be live in the Slack channel, you know, at noon on Tuesday to be talking about this after the episode comes out on Monday. And just have it be a natural extension. Hey, listen to the podcast, come over to the community to keep talking about it with the host or the hosts and with other community members.
Cool. Well, Craig, you gave us a ton of advice on this episode, and it was really interesting talking to you. I'm super impressed by what you built with Castos, and as I mentioned to you a few times on the call, a lot of things that you're doing and the way you bootstrapped it and deciding to take an investment are things that we're thinking about all the time at Thought Leaders, and you've been really impressive in the way you made those decisions. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and sharing with us today.
Very kind. Thank you very much. It was a ton of fun. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Thought Leaders podcast. If you'd like to learn more about what's trending in the online sphere, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn and sign up for our weekly newsletter at thoughtleaders.io. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts to stay tuned for the next episode. This podcast was hosted by David Tintner, edited by and produced by me, Noam Yadin.